This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live this week from at least Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday from New York City. Here we are, the home of our affiliate WWRL and of the headquarters of the Air America Radio Network. So, broadcasting live from L.A. to New York and many, many, many points in between. A lot in the news today. George Bush's budget is out, and I want to get into some of the details of this thing. It is absolutely mind-boggling what he is proposing to do in order to preserve his tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, and how badly it's going to hurt America. So we have that, and a new book out. It's actually going to be coming out tomorrow, but basically suggesting that 9/11 happened because Condi Rice really wasn't interested in being a national security advisor. She just wanted to be George W. Bush's best buddy. And that John Ashcroft was more concerned about Lady Liberty, or the statue of, you know, the woman holding the scales of justice, that her breasts were covered. And Alberto Gonzalez was just being totally partisan. I mean, it's amazing. So anyhow, a lot going on. We'll be getting into that. We'll be taking your calls throughout the day. We're going to have a number of people on throughout our program today talking about, in particular, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, although John Bolton is going to join us in the third hour. That should be an interesting conversation. Right now, Gordon Fisher's on the line with us. He's an attorney and the former chairman of the Democratic Party of Iowa. And Gordon Fisher, welcome to the program.
Tom, great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thanks so much for coming on. A lot of good news for Barack Obama right now. The Maria Shriver endorsing him. There's a bunch of things I'd like to go through with you.
Sure.
First of all, the sense that I got of this, I spent most of yesterday on airplanes, and so I was just kind of catch as catch can with the news and trying to catch up this morning. But the sense that I got it was that this was kind of off the cuff, last minute, and that Arnold didn't know about it. Is that an accurate appraisal?
Yeah, I think it was something that, according to First Lady Maria Shriver, she thought about. She thought about that morning. She went to the rally and was pacing backstage, wondering whether to make her endorsement public or not, after she heard at least some of the speeches by Carolyn Kennedy and Oprah and Michelle Obama. She decided to come out publicly, and it was a big, big surprise and shock. And I happened to be watching it live on C-SPAN, and I was blown away, and the blogs immediately lit up with the news. It was really quite amazing.
Yeah, this is the First Lady of California, the wife of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the daughter of one of John Kennedy's sisters.
Exactly, and you know, the timing is phenomenal. As other folks have pointed out, it obviously led all the newscasts in California. It was in all the California papers yesterday. That will continue today, and may actually bleed over into Tuesday, as Governor Schwarzenegger himself has asked about Maria's endorsement. It's great news, along with the MoveOn.org endorsement. I mean, it really shows that Obama can bring people together.
Right, and I'm curious, is the California primary an open or closed primary?
That is a fascinating question, because my understanding is that it is open on the Democratic side but closed on the Republican side.
Oh, that's interesting.
One would think would favor Obama, but that's just my understanding. I have to admit, I'm not a California politics expert.
Yeah.
I do know that the Obama campaign has a voter hotline if folks have questions about, you know, Obama's bringing in a lot of new people, young people, independents, minorities, Republicans even, into the process. And if folks have questions about, in the 20-plus states that are voting tomorrow, they can call 866-675-2008. That's 866-675-2008 to find out, you know, exactly what the deal is in their state.
Okay, great. Good to know that. Also, Paul Krugman today in his op-ed in the New York Times. Paul is no slouch when it comes to economics. I mean, he really knows his stuff. Professor of economics at Princeton, as I recall.
Yep.
And he's been a guest on this program many times. I've read several of his books and read his column regularly. And he comes out and says, you know, there really is a big difference between Barack Obama's health care plan and Hillary Clinton's health care plan. He's kind of endorsing Hillary Clinton's. Do you think that Barack Obama is going to be positioning his health care plan as, well, this is a first try, but we're going to do something more? Or, I mean, what's your take on this?
Well, my take is somewhat different from Paul Krugman, although I agree that he is absolutely brilliant, and I really enjoy his columns. He's not been particularly kind to Senator Obama in some of his past columns, so I don't know that today's column is much of a surprise. But
so, do you see him as a Hillary Clinton partisan?
Yeah, kind of. I do. I mean,
oh, interesting.
There's been a pretty steady stream of columns criticizing Senator Obama on a wide range of issues, of which health care is the latest. But, you know, one, you know, important thing to remember is electability. And I think it's a very, very difficult argument to make to the general election population that we are going to mandate health insurance. And because once you get into the word mandate, and that's what Senator Clinton wants, she wants to mandate health insurance for everyone, then you have to get into, well, how are you going to do that? How exactly are you going to mandate health insurance for everyone? And in fact, yesterday, on this week, she was forced to admit that garnishing folks' wages is one way that she would enforce her mandate. That is not a winning general election strategy, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Folks that are working families here in Iowa, working families across the country, do not want to see their wages garnished for a national health insurance plan when they already may have insurance or may have other options for insurance. So I think the mandate is very, very troublesome.
Yeah, it's a shame that the candidates apparently just, you know, it can't fly politically at the moment. Can't just, you know, propose what Harry Truman proposed back in 47, which is Medicare for all.
I agree. Senator Obama has said many times that if he were starting the health care system from scratch, if he were beginning it from scratch, that he would go with a single-payer system.
Yeah.
But because it's become such a big part of our economy, our employment, our lives, our society, he doesn't just think that's realistic. And I think what he's offering really makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Or
no
yeah.
mandates, but making sure that folks are covered.
Yeah, one of the points that John Edwards made on this program a while ago was that because his program allowed anybody to buy into Medicare, and Medicare only has a 3% overhead, a 2 to 3% overhead, whereas most private for-profit health insurance plans have anywhere from 20 to 30% overhead because they have to pay their stockholders dividends and the CEO's multi-million dollar salaries, and in the case of William McGuire, a $1.78 billion compensation package. Over a period of time, perhaps a few years, the health insurance companies, by and large, would probably vanish, you know, or change tremendously as a consequence of that.
Sure.
Is that ability to buy into Medicare by anybody in the country included in Senator Obama's health care plan?
That is a good question, and I honestly do not know the answer. I don't want to flim-flam you, but
yeah.
I do know that experts have looked at Obama's health care plan. And folks that are nonpartisan or bipartisan have said that it will cover every American, does more to cut costs than any other plan, and will save the typical family up to $2,500 in premiums. So, and I have also heard Senator Obama say that there's really not a gigantic difference, frankly, between Senator Edwards' health care plan, Senator Clinton's health care plan, and Barack Obama's health care plan.
Yeah.
They're fairly similar. The one big difference we've already talked about, mandates, I think otherwise they're very, very close.
Yeah. We have about a half a minute left. The main reasons, Gordon Fisher, why you're supporting Barack Obama?
Well, electability is certainly one. I think Barack Obama can reach out to Republicans, independents that frankly Senator Clinton cannot. There's been a couple of national polls recently that show Senator Obama beating John McCain while Senator Clinton loses to John McCain. So electability is absolutely key. Second, change agent. I think if we want to change Washington, which so many of us desperately do, I think Barack Obama is the true change agent in this race. He is the one that's proposing true ethics reform, true reform in so many different areas. So I think electability, change agent, those are the things that should be on voters' minds as they head to Super Tuesday. Yeah. And check out BarackObama.com for more information on the issues.
There you go. Gordon Fisher, the former head of the Iowa, the Democratic Party of Iowa, the former chairman. Gordon,
that's
thanks
right.
for being with us.
Tom, thanks so much for having me. Have a great day.
Tom Hartman, speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Even if your hands are shaking and your faith is broken, even as the eyes are closing, do it with a heart wide open. My heart, say what you need to say. Say what you need to say.
And welcome back. You know, it's odd. I've gotten a number of emails from people. First of all, both on our message board, our blog, in our chat room, over at TomHartman.com, and also the blog over at AirAmerica.com, you know, it's interesting this variety of commentary. Number one, hey, why don't you endorse somebody? Well, I'm trying to give as much credit as possible to my listeners. A, in other words, you guys can make up your own mind, and B. Right now, I'd have to flip a coin. I mean, I could argue strongly the reasons for or against either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, and I frankly think that they're both very, very strong candidates, and I'm going to be perfectly content with whatever the will of the voters are, and we will have a little later on in the program, we're going to have Senator John Kerry on. He's going to be talking about Barack Obama. We're also going to have Senator Evan Bayon talking about Hillary Clinton. And so, you know, I want to just allow these candidates, largely through their surrogates, to get their message out, and you can decide. I mean, you can make up your mind. Anything. Keep in mind, the next president of the United States is going to be appointing a couple of Supreme Court justices. I mean, this is a big deal. This election is a big deal. Then I also have seen a number of people who are saying, hey, wait a minute. You're a progressive, and I am. In fact, one person pointed out, you know, hey, you used to be an SDS. I mean, you know, you're about as radical as they come, and yet you're talking about a couple of centrist candidates and speaking well of them. How can that be? I thought that you were progressive. Well, let's consider, it's time, I think, for history lesson, you know, history 101. Here's the problem that we have in the United States, and it is a problem. And we need to do something about it. And many places have. The city of San Francisco, for example, over 300 communities across the United States, in fact, have with instant runoff voting. But here's the problem. When the founders of this country came up with this radical notion, and keep in mind, in 1776, it was a radical notion. It was such a radical notion that about 50 years later, in 1836 or 1834, when Alexis de Tocqueville came over here, a young French aristocrat, to travel around the United States, and 2 years later his book, Democracy in America, was published. It was like, you know, just totally, you know, this is an experiment. What, people governing themselves? This is just a huge experiment. And when the Civil War happened all over the world, but in particularly in Europe, they were saying, see, told you it wouldn't last. And everybody was waiting for the United States to collapse. So anyway, when the founders put this thing together, this radical experiment of having representative democracy in a constitutionally limited republic, the one fly in the ointment, the one problem, and James Madison was the guy who saw it, arguably the father of the Constitution, the guy who had worked the hardest on the Constitution, took all the constitutional notes. He and Alexander Hamilton wrote the Federalist Papers to sell the Constitution. And ultimately, he became, I believe, the fourth president of the United States, if I'm remembering my numbers right. James Madison in, as I recall, Federalist Number 10. It's been a while since I've read the Federalist Papers, but I'm pretty sure it's Federalist Number 10. He addressed this problem built into our system, and that is that if political parties emerged, and keep in mind, when the Constitution was passed, there were no political parties. If political parties emerged, and you had two political parties, then it was conceivable that you could have the will of the majority of the people decide something. In other words, you could have a 51% majority. 49% would not get their way, but the majority would get their way, and that would be small d democratic. But if you had three political parties emerge, and two candidates got 33% of the vote each, and the third candidate got 34% of the vote, then you would have a minority making decisions in the United States. If you had four political parties, you could have somebody with 26% of the vote making decisions. If you had five political parties, you could have somebody with 21% of the vote. If you had six political parties, I think it goes down to like 17 or whatever it is. You know, I can't do math in my head that fast, but you get the point. And so Madison was like, what are we going to do about this? If political parties emerge and there's more than two of them, we will not have a democratic outcome. And the best solution he could come up with in Federalist Number 10 was to beg Americans never to form what he called factions in Federalist 10. And I encourage you to go, you know, read it online, which was the word back then for political parties. Please don't form political parties. Well, you know, within 10 years, James Madison himself, or within 15 years, was the head of or one of the two leaders of the Democratic Republican Party, which is today known as the Democratic Party. So because we have winner-take-all, first-past-the-post elections, and the Republicans still do in their primaries, although the Democrats at least have gone to proportional representation, we have this problem. And until we solve that, and we could either solve it by amending our Constitution to go to proportional representation, which I think would be a bad idea, or by instant runoff voting, which doesn't require a constitutional amendment and can be done and has already been done in over 300 communities around the United States, we and Greece and Canada and Australia, New Zealand are basically, that's it. We're the countries where that problem exists. Although in New Zealand and Australia, they fixed it with instant runoff voting. And we need to do the same here.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We wake up each morning and start every day with coffee, espresso, and grande lattes. Racing the traffic and bitch while we wait. Pissed at the world for making us late. We punch in at lunch and then punch out again. Rush home to clean up the messes we left. Microwave dinner, then put it to bed. Tomorrow we'll do it all over again. That's just a day.
But there's a lot of good stuff. Hey, we're having a good time here on the program. And frankly, there is so much promise. There is so much promise in this country. And then you look at this budget that George Bush just rolled out, slashing over 100 domestic programs to preserve his tax cuts for his rich buddies, millionaires and billionaires. It is absolutely mind-boggling. I want to get into that in a little bit. But first, Al Franken is on the line with us, one of my absolute favorite people. Al, you and I were radio competitors for a while, and I was very honored to
take... We went head-to-head, Tom.
And friends.
I have some bitter feelings about that.
Oh, yeah.
Nevertheless, I'm coming on.
Thank you.
Because I need you, man.
And I was so honored when Air America chose me to pick up the time slot that you left when you went to run for the Senate. And I wanted to check in with you. And I understand, according to this University of Minnesota poll, is it? Or Minnesota Public Radio poll. Yeah, and University of Minnesota's Humphrey Institute.
Right.
That you're doing very well, and it looks like Norm Coleman is really going to have a problem this fall.
Well, you know, I try not to take too much stock in polls unless I'm ahead in them.
Yeah.
And then I do.
Well, I think you're ahead.
So this one means a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, actually, it's there's been a trend, which is very good, and this is the first poll that has me ahead of them. But you know, many slip twixt the cup and lip, and we have a long ways to go. But it's been everything's been going very well here in Minnesota, and And we have our caucuses tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And want all our Air America listeners in Minnesota to turn out for me.
Yeah, we're on several different stations in Minnesota. What do you see, Al Franken, as the major issues from a Minnesota point of view, but national issues as well? That what are the real issues for you in this race?
The real issues, there are a number of them. They all kind of fit together. Obviously, it's healthcare, and it's education, and it's jobs, and it's middle class squeeze. And I mean, you're just talking about this slashing the domestic budget. There are people who, you know, who have kids who are someone who has a kid who's developmentally disabled, and they live in a group home. Okay, and the group home is great. And the group home has been providing care for 20 years for this person, or, you know, has been a home, literally a home, and the group home is a family. And suddenly, because of defunding of this, they are kicked out of their group home, and which is a government group home, into a private, for-profit group home. So they're just the most vulnerable people in America.
So somebody can make a buck off them.
So someone can make a buck off them. And what they do is these people who see group homes as a way of making a profit, what they do is they understaff them. They don't pay the, they don't give staff the number of hours. They don't pay them to sleep over. It goes from that. It's all about these, what it comes down to is the special interests. And we need a change. We need a change in our political culture. And we need someone to stand up for working families and for, the people of Minnesota and the people of this country and stand up to the special interests. So it's the cost of education for people. People are worried about being able to send their kids to college. It's about jobs going overseas. It's about wages not going up. It's about the fact that only 15% of our workers now belong, are members of unions.
Right. And if you take out government employees, it's down to like 7%, I think.
Without government employees.
Yeah. I mean, it's a record low.
Yeah. And that isn't the same as, let's say, take Canada. Now, Canada has the same trade agreements we have, has the same technology we have. They have the same, they have 30% of their workforce are members of unions. It's because we have a political culture that's hostile.
Yeah, and has been since Reagan. I mean, Reagan essentially declared war on working people, and it's been unrelenting. There was a brief pause during the Clinton administration, but that was about it.
And it's part of the movement conservative. Movement conservatives have, when they kind of took over this country in the late 70s. I mean, even before Reagan, when they became the Republican movement. And there's nothing, I make the argument there's nothing really conservative about these Republicans. There's nothing conservative about running $250 billion deficits year after year. There's nothing conservative about the president claiming, powers under the Constitution that don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing conservative about suppressing science. There's nothing conservative about invading a country on false pretenses and lying to the people.
It even goes beyond that. There's nothing American about those things. Those are inconsistent with historic American values.
Yes. So, that's what this is all about. It's really about changing the political culture.
Mm-hmm.
People are yearning for this, and they're showing up. I did about a 6-day tour of northern Minnesota and then crossing over to northwestern Minnesota and from the northeastern Minnesota and then going down the western part of Minnesota. And we had, in Wadena, Minnesota, a small town, 250 people. Thank God one of them wasn't the fire marshal. We had in Fergus Falls and Crookston and all over in these small towns, people just jamming in and just yearning for a change.
Yeah, and I understand at the national level the same thing is happening with the Democratic candidates, with Hillary Clinton and particularly with Barack Obama. You know, huge, mind-boggling crowds in both cases. And on the Republican side, you know, it was so tragic. I mean, Giuliani would show up someplace and nine people would be there and eight of them were on his staff. You know, it's even John McCain is having a hard time drawing crowds, and he's supposed to be the anointed rock star now.
Right. I mean, he ain't, you know.
No.
And
he's yesterday's news.
Because, you know, John McCain is, you know, I'd look at those debates and go, well, there is an adult here. Mm. But, you know, the Straight Talk Express went off the rails.
Yeah.
Let's face it.
Yeah.
You know, he voted against the Bush tax cuts for a reason. And now he's for making them permanent.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is... The one thing I really liked about John McCain in 2000 was he said, you know, I'm going to tell you things that you don't want to hear. And then, of course, he went down to South Carolina, and I had McCain on our show when he wrote a book called Courage Matters. Mm-hmm. And this is because I know John and we've been friends. And I said to him, you know, you went down to South Carolina, and when you were asked about the Confederate flag flying over the Capitol, you said it was a state issue or something.
Yeah.
And later, and I remember you're saying at the end of all your town meetings that I'm going to always tell you the truth, and I'm going to say stuff even though you don't want to hear it. What was that about? Because later he said that he hadn't been telling the truth there.
Right.
And he said, yeah, yeah. And I said, and you've written a book called Courage Matters. Was that wasn't courageous, was it? And he said, no.
At least he's owning up to it. You know, there are other politicians who would have just weaseled out of that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I
think we're both at the point of saying that we both have some respect for John McCain, even though his policies would destroy this country.
Yes, I mean, you know,
and his Supreme Court nominees would really destroy this country.
Yeah, you've that is a funny way of putting it, but you're exactly right.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is why you got the time slot.
Thank you, Al Franken. I wish you so well, and if there's, you know, you're always welcome on this program.
Oh, thanks.
You know, please let us know if you got any kind of news hook or anything you want to get on.
Okay, great.
You know, we reached out to you this time. I feel free to reach out to us. We'd love to have you on.
Okay.
And thanks so much for dropping by.
Always a pleasure, and I'll give you a call soon.
Okay, great.
Okay, Tom.
Thanks
for having me.
Hey, Al.
Yeah.
Your website.
Oh, alfranken.com.
Alfranken.com.
Okay,
cool. All righty.
Thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, have a good one. Happy campaigning.
Thanks, bye.
Okay, bye now. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Judith in Manhattan, New York. Hey, Judith.
Hi, Tom. I just want to be in the minority of Democrats and disagree with all my friends, actually, their position on mandates. My husband and I are both voting for Hillary really just for the fact that she has a health care plan that is mandated, just like John Edwards was mandated. And
without a mandate, ultimately, you're not going to have a system that works, in my opinion. And I think that, you know, if Barack Obama is the nominee, he's going to have to come around to this. It's like Social Security is mandated.
Well, may I just tell you, low-cost insurance, health insurance, sounds wonderful. But real life often diverges greatly from one's perception.
Right.
If I could illustrate my family after the break, I'd like to make this point because it's not being made anywhere except by Paul Krugman, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I think I can make it for you, Judith, but
okay.
I appreciate your call, and I do agree with your sentiment on mandates, frankly, you know, on that one issue. But that's just one of many issues, and time will tell. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Okay, here's another song, Down Memory Lane with GW, that's me, and the Carlisle Group. Here we go. They are saying that I knew and that I lied to you.
Well, I think you did, George.
But
Well, that's true. Condi lied to us.
Smoking guns. We blow smoke in your eyes.
Yeah.
Well, that's because you get news from your TV and they cover up for me.
Yeah, they did a pretty good job, really. Especially growing up to that war.
They don't ask why towers fell, because we pay them really well to blow smoke in your eyes.
Welcome back. 51 minutes past the hour. Listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting the sponsors of our local affiliates and our national sponsors, including SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers declaring that right should, excuse me, that health care should be a right, not a privilege. I absolutely agree. 866-303-2270, our number. Matt in Napa, California. You want to disagree with me, Matt? Hey.
Morning, Tom. First of all, I do want to preface it by saying I do appreciate your attitude about third parties and the supporting IRV and some of the solutions.
Well, and I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000.
Right.
It's not like I'm constitutionally opposed to third parties.
Right, and I agree there is a circular firing squad thing that's going on, and it's a difficult situation, and I sort of hesitate to say some of the things I'm going to say about it, but I just want to put this point of view out there, and you
sure.
mentioned Nader, and usually you refer to it at this point as that you made a mistake, and
well,
kind of that there's an objection. Could I just make three
sure, questions? but let me just
okay.
say, I've never said that I made a mistake voting for Ralph Nader. I was living in Vermont, and my wife and I split our vote. She voted for Al Gore. I voted for Ralph Nader. And I still think it was a good idea for me to do it at the time in that place because we knew that that was a blue state,
uh-huh.
number one. And number two, I wanted the Green Party to get their 5 or 15%, whatever the threshold that they had to get for matching funds for future elections. I wanted to support the Green Party. And so I thought that was a good thing. And David Cobb in 2004, when he ran as the Green Party's nominee, and David is a good friend and a brilliant, brilliant guy. David did what Ralph Nader should have done, and that is to say, hey, listen, if you vote in a swing state, don't vote for me. And if you vote in a solidly blue state, consider giving me your vote so that the Green Party can get some traction here in the state. I am a total supporter of the Green Party and other progressive parties at the grassroots level, at the state level, at the county level. I think it's really important that they be out there. Progressive parties, third parties have historically been the engines that have pushed the major parties in more progressive directions throughout the history of this country.
Okay. Your
turn.
Can I make three quick points?
Sure.
On
your
it?
Turn.
Okay. Just some of the things that I observe is, you know, that doesn't seem like there's any criteria or expectations that you talk a lot about what we can expect out of these candidates in the future and that they're sort of somewhat victims of political forces at times. Also, you know, the blocking of Nader's ballot access last time, I think there's real issues with democracy that are going on here.
Yep.
You know, that we're letting go on the sake of just, you know, anybody but the Republicans. And then finally on Madison's Federalist, you know, I've looked at it a little bit. It seems to me like the part of the argument that maybe is not explicitly stated there took place somewhere else. He's talking about factionalism, but I don't, you know, you referenced that.
At the time he wrote that, the word political parties did not exist.
Okay, I didn't see a discussion about third parties there, I guess is what I'm saying. And the whole idea that a 50% threshold is, you know, yeah. almost some sort of magical distinction rather than a proportional system, I don't see that clearly, especially
yeah.
a tyranny of the majority came
see,
into
the,
play, a proportional system.
The problem was that proportional election systems really weren't invented. I mean, John Stuart Mill put them forward in a pamphlet, I'm forgetting the title of it, in 1861. And that, and most European countries and frankly most democracies around the world came into being after 1861, and they used John Stuart Mill's idea of proportional representation, where if your party gets 22% of the vote, then you get 22% of the seats in the House or in the Parliament or whatever. And if it gets 71% of the vote, it gets it. And so you end up with a whole bunch of parties that have to cooperate and collaborate and work together, and everybody actually has a voice. And I think that that's a great system. It's just that's not how our Constitution was written, and the only way to remedy that is instant runoff voting. And you know who's been the champion of instant runoff voting is the Green Party. They're responsible for being there in over 300 counties or localities around the United States. The mayor of San Francisco, I believe, is a Green, and because of instant runoff voting, and the Democratic and Republican parties have been strong opponents of instant runoff voting, and I condemn them for that. So, I don't, I'm not sure, Matt, that we disagree so much, but your points are well taken, and I can't refute them. Well said. Thank you. Paul in Massachusetts, listening on 1420 AM. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Tom. This is Paul from Gill, Massachusetts, the Connecticut River Valley Gateway to Vermont.
Oh, that's great. What's up, Paul?
I'm in the camp that believes that Hillary Clinton's medical program is better. I think it's closer to Edwards. I'm an Edwards disappointee.
Yeah.
The other thing is,
I don't think that we should judge any. That said, I think that neither of these two candidates should be judged on any one particular issue. We really have to take them as a whole. A and B, you have to realize that a campaign platform does not necessarily translate into what's actually going to happen as legislation down the road. And we've seen that with every single president in the history of this country.
I agree with that. That's a great parade you talk of.
Yeah.
Here is my real point. Some months ago, you had a program talking about biases and people's preferences and so forth, and I found that program very interesting. And it's a must that we win this election. And I think, based on the criteria you talked about, Hillary Clinton is the far better candidate.
Interesting. Paul, thanks.
That's something you have to think about.
Yeah, no, as I said, I think that they're both great candidates, and that's why I'm not endorsing either one. I'm saying I give my listeners credit for their intelligence. Coming up next, Senator John Kerry.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Call 866-303-2270. Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations.
Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. About 20 minutes past the hour, John Kerry's going to drop by. At the bottom of the hour, Senator Evan Bayh is going to drop by. Kerry speaking on behalf of Obama, Bayh speaking on behalf of Hillary Clinton. It's going to be an interesting day. And you speaking on behalf of whomever you'd like. Or whatever you'd like, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Paul in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Good day, sir. Thanks for all you do.
You're welcome.
I think we have an interesting opportunity here with this, by the votes of people with the tax rebate, that something I have been trumpeting for quite a while. If we were, and I would be the first to line up, to sign my $1,800 check over to a law firm a la Earth Justice, that would put into place the lawsuits and the charges that need to go against so many people, from the impeachment or recusement of the Supreme Court justices who broke the law in 2000 to Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney when they're out of office, that we should be able to charge these people outside of the umbrella of politics, and we need a law firm that can do that. With my $1,800 and maybe 100,000 other homes who would be willing to do this, we'd have $1 billion to put on retainer a law firm, probably in perpetuity, so that we do not repeat the crimes of this administration.
Wow, and I know just the law firm. It would be Mike Papatonio
amazing.
And Bobby Kennedy's.
It would be amazing.
Yeah,
but
I'd love
to hear
would.
Your opinion, because we have to do this legally.
I think it's a great idea, Paul, and although it's going to take, it would take some sort of a national organization to pull it together, you might be able to create one if you can build a website and get enough people to it, or convince MoveOn.org or something like that to participate. It is going to be a challenge, though, to get people to part with cash. But,
I think right now, but people will say that if we do have a chance to do something, they could take this money that would probably fall in the black hole of my personal finances anyway,
and
see it as the bribe that it is, and turn the money back on these scoundrels who won't even extend unemployment insurance.
Yeah. Can you imagine how the Republicans would have responded if Democratic appointees on the Supreme Court had given their nominee the election when he got 5 million more votes or fewer votes. You know what I mean? I'd say if this thing was flipped around, if it was the Republicans on the losing side of it, they would be screaming. They, you know what? The president wants to wiretap me. He must be listening in on my political conversations. I mean, it just never would have ended. Paul, excellent point. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Elizabeth in Chandler, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, Tom. I was in agreement with that caller a couple callers back regarding Hillary and health care.
Mm-hmm.
And my problem between the two candidates is that I don't think Obama is being adequately vetted. And so I don't think she's getting a fair shake in comparison with him. And I think he's getting a little bit of a free ride in the media, especially with important issues such as health care.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, if he is the party's nominee, that free ride is going to end. It's going to come to a screeching halt the day after the nominee is announced, because the Republicans are going to come out with their guns blazing. But to a certain extent, there's not that much of a political record there. You know, unlike John Kennedy, who'd been in the legislature for 14 years, and before that, you know, had fought in World War II. Barack Obama has only held national elective office for a short while, for a couple of years, and he, in the one campaign he ran in, he ran against a cartoon character, Alan Keyes.
Right.
But, you know, that said, and those are his negatives, I suppose. And,
well,
you know,
do you know any of his other personal business ties that are going to come back to haunt him?
Well, you know, I suspect, but, you know, then you've got Hillary Clinton, who was on the board of directors at Walmart for 6 years. I mean, it's not like, as I said, I could build a case against either one of these candidates. I could build a case for either one of these candidates. And their surrogates are doing a good job of both out there. And I just, you know, these are the candidates that we have right at this point. And either one of them is going to appoint reasonable Supreme Court judges. Either one of them, they both have, you know, more than 90% progressive voting records. If you look at, you know, several of the, any of the groups, conservative or middle of the road or even progressive, that rank voting records. So, you know, yeah, neither one of them is perfect. But the bottom line is, if we, the people, get energized and activated, and one of these two is elected president of the United States, we can push them in more progressive directions. I am absolutely convinced of that, because that's what's happened in the past in American history. And Lyndon Johnson, who would have ever thought that this, you know, essentially conservative racist cracker from Texas would be the guy who would transform America with regard to civil rights legislation? Well, he did it because Martin Luther King, he did it because the people, not to denigrate or not to put down Martin Luther King, but Martin Luther King was the symbol of a huge movement. I mean, there were a lot of people out there, and that pushed Lyndon Johnson in a direction that, frankly, I think 20 years earlier, he never would have even imagined going in.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yeah.
Sure. Most often when people talk about Obama and why they like him, I don't hear any tangibles. They just say he brings hope and change, and I don't know what they mean by that. I mean, other than he's the first half African-American candidate.
Well, I'd suggest you go to his website then, barackobama.com, because he, just like hillaryclinton.com, both of them have all of their position papers right out there for you to see, and they're pretty unambiguous. And you know, I don't. There are some areas where there's not a lot of light between them. There are some areas where there is a little. But the bottom line is, either one of them is going to be better than any Republican. Elizabeth, I got to move along, but I thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Steve in Los Angeles, listening on K Talk. Hey, Steve.
Good morning. I'm living in Los Angeles. I vote tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 57 years old. For the first time in my life, I don't know who to vote for.
I know, it's a tough one.
On a substantive basis, when you speak to the two surrogates, would you, you described it best from my point of view. In many areas, they are almost identical, and those areas where they're different, it's almost nuanced. I'd like to hear specific factual differences between the two. They're not based on personality or prospective electability or anything like that. Just what's the difference between the two?
I don't think that there are that many substantial differences. I mean, I've had surrogates on for both campaigns over the last week, and we're going to have some more on as we go on throughout the day. And I'll continue asking that question. But I think what it's going to come down to is at the final, at the end of the day, that Hillary Clinton is presenting herself as kind of the policy wonk, roll up her sleeves, this is her phrase, roll up my sleeves, get work done, you know, the hardworking person, and Barack Obama is presenting himself as the leader who can reach across the aisle, draw people together, and heal this nation's wounds. And I suspect that those are both true statements. And so it's like, you know, what are we going to do? I mean, it's that's why the line that got the I don't know if it was a standing ovation, but it certainly got the biggest hoots and hollers at the Democratic debate was that last question of, you know, a dream ticket being an Obama Clinton or Clinton Obama team. And you know, it's I think it's true. I speaking as a guy who, and, you know, has never endorsed a presidential candidate on the air during a primary. I mean, I worked very hard for John Kerry's campaign 4 years ago when I was on the air. And after that election was essentially stolen in Ohio, we spent about 2 weeks on this program doing, I think, you know, suicide support. You know, on, you know, people. I mean, people were calling. We literally had a couple people calling in, you know, talking about suicide. I mean, people were just devastated. You know, as a person who really, I thought John Edwards was a great guy. I think Dennis Kucinich is a great guy. What we have are Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and they are both, in my opinion, they both have the potential to be great presidents.
In my opinion, I believe they're both going to give me the same kind of justices. I believe they're both going to give me approximately the same kind of foreign
policy.
Policy. I believe that they both will veto the same kinds of bills and approve the same kinds of bills, and that's where I'm stuck. And tomorrow, with all due respect to Senator Kerry, who I did vote for, who was tagged with the moniker flip-flop, that's me.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I get it, Steve, and I you know, I absolutely get it, and I understand and agree with you. It's just a tough one, and so that's why, you know, we're just going to continue, and thanks for the call. We're just going to continue talking about it, continue having on the program, you know, at least for the next 24 hours. I mean, it's happening tomorrow. It's happening tomorrow. I'm part of why I'm here in New York. I'll be doing some of the, you know, some commentary tomorrow night on this issue, and then of course we're going to the CPAC conference, the Conservative Political Action Conference, Thursday and Friday. We'll be doing our show live from that. That should be very interesting because the conservative movement really is all, you know, wrung out. I mean, they're just freaking out. They just don't know what to do. You know, John McCain, oh no. You've got Ann Coulter endorsing Hillary Clinton. I mean, you know, it's what does that mean? But in any case, I'm right there with you, Steve. It's like, you know, what do we do? I think I said on the air last week, Louise and I were thinking, you know, if Oregon had been one of the Super Tuesday states, and it's not, that we would just split our vote. I just don't know. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
No, that's not what democracy means, I'll tell you. 1-866-303-2270, our number. Glenn in California. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Hi there. I'm horrified at the thought of a Hillary candidacy. I think it'd be a gift of epic proportions to the Republicans. Let me give you an example of this leadership she keeps talking about. She voted against John Roberts' confirmation to the Supreme Court. But before she did that, she announced that she supported him, and it knocked all the wind out of the sails of all the Democrats trying to rally opposition against him. So was that incompetence or was that just skillful triangulation? I think it's the kind of betrayal that we can expect from a Hillary presidency.
Yeah. Well, as I said, Glenn, there, you know, I can share with you a long list of my concerns about Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama for that matter. And ultimately, at the end of the day, like with Lyndon Johnson, I mean, I could have given you an even longer list. With Franklin Roosevelt, I mean, you know, he went into office the election of 32. I was doing a blog thing over at FireDogLake.com on Saturday, and we were talking about this. In the election of 32, the platform that Franklin Roosevelt ran on was that he was going to slightly modestly adjust the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. I mean, that was pretty much it. There was no mention of Social Security. There was no mention of bringing about unionization. You know, in 1935, the National Labor Relations Act. There was no mention of unemployment insurance. There was no, I mean, all the progressive reforms that he brought about, it wasn't even talking about. They came about because the American people were demanding them. And I just, you know, my sense is that we now have an engaged populace that we didn't have before. But Glenn, I get your point, and thank you for the call. I mean, here, for example, this is an email that I just got. It's from Matt. And I'm going to give out his last name. He says, "Dear Tom," and apparently he's in Hawaii. He says, "Tom, I listen to your show by a podcast in the morning when I work out, so usually I'm a day behind. Listen to your Friday show this morning. You had a lot of callers in the latter hour of the show saying they don't see the change happening in America that you see. I am 25 years old. I missed the 2000 election by 1 month. My birthday is December 30th. I was disheartened by the election immensely. It turned me off to politics so much that I didn't vote in 2004. Late in 2005, I picked up a book by Al Franken. After finishing it, I subscribed to his show via podcast on AirAmerica.com. When Al went to visit Iraq, he turned his airtime over to you. Al Franken gave me hope in the American system. Your show taught me that the only way for that system to work is to be active myself. I now call my congressman regularly because of your show. I am that change. Thank you." And so, you know, good on you, Matt. Thank you so much for that. Senator John Kerry on the line with us. Senator John Kerry, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Sir, I voted for you. I worked for you in the last election, which I continue to think that you won. But we're not going to talk about that. Let's talk about the next election.
Thank you.
You want to speak on behalf of Barack Obama.
Well, I believe that Barack Obama has the opportunity to be literally a transitional president. I think he's inspiring people across the country, bringing Democrats, Republicans, and independents together. I think you're seeing the kind of coalition build that augurs well for our ability to be able to solve problems and govern, because you're seeing people like the senator from Nebraska, who's the former governor, Ben Nelson, support Barack Obama, Governor Kathleen Sebelius of Kansas, Governor Napolitano of Arizona, the senators from the Democratic senators from South and North Dakota, the governor of Virginia. Tim Kaine is supporting him. I think that there's Claire McCaskill of Missouri. What that says is these are all savvy elected officials who know how to govern in their states, and they're supporting Barack Obama because they believe that he can lead us to a more effective governance. And I think that's very, very important. Second thing, I believe Barack Obama has the ability to reach out to other countries and to present a new face and a new story for America that's particularly uplifting, particularly in keeping with the fundamental values of who we are as a country, with words that we profess, the dreams that we hold out to people. That's really what Barack Obama stands for. It's an exciting opportunity to have this kind of transformation, to embrace the future, not the past.
Sir, we have about a half a minute left. The policy differences between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama don't seem to be that great. You're calling for us to support him because of his style?
No. Look, you just said it. The policy differences aren't that great, and it's true. They're not, except that what they're electing in a president is judgment and wisdom and vision and direction and character. And I think, looking at Barack Obama, the fact that he was right on the war makes a difference. He had the right policy. I think he has the right policy now. I think he's been correct about wanting to reach out to leaders of other countries, including Iran or Syria, in order not to give away our principles, but to engage in a way that advances the cause, like Ronald Reagan did talking to Gorbachev, or Richard Nixon did reaching out to Mao Zedong in Red China. Those changes came about because we had visionary leadership. And I think that Barack has talked in substantive terms in ways that really speak more to the future.
You make a compelling case. Senator John Kerry, thank you so much for coming on the program, sir.
Good to be with you.
Good talking with you today. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
To the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
no matter what the cost is, you know getting it ain't hard. You just sign along the dotted line, you can take it home today. Buddy, let me tell you, you're gonna pay and pay and pay, old MasterCard. You mastered me. I'll still be paying when I'm 83. Things I bought are broke or gone. Old MasterCard.
Sort of sounds like George W. Bush's motto with the federal budget. Like, let's borrow money. We'll give some tax cuts to our millionaire, billionaire friends and borrow that money from China. And anyway, the Honorable Senator Evan Bayh is on the line with us, the Democrat from Indiana. Senator Bayh, welcome to the program.
Tom, good to be with you.
Thank you. John Kerry was on our program just a few minutes ago talking about the wonders of Barack Obama and why he's supporting him. And I asked him the same question I want to start out by asking you, and that is that the policy differences between Senator Clinton and Senator Obama don't seem to be that great. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, early on in campaigns, or even late on in campaigns, policies that are put out don't necessarily end up being the laws that get produced. What are the substantive differences between these two candidates that cause you to want to endorse or to have endorsed and speak on behalf of Senator Hillary Clinton as opposed to Barack Obama?
Well, let me say a couple things about that, Tom. First, I've known Senator Clinton for more than 20 years, and it's largely her strength, her experience. I think this is going to be a substantive election, and it's not going to turn so much on the differences between the two candidates in terms of the specifics of their proposals as to, you know, who knows how best to produce the results. And I just think she has a better track record of doing that kind of thing. Now, the one substantive difference that I think your listeners would be interested in and will be significant is the whole health care debate. And where we start off, as you point out, things evolve and compromises are made in terms of the process of striking a consensus to actually get something done. But where you start off is very important. And if you give away a lot at the beginning, you're likely to end up with even less at the end. And Senator Clinton has staked out a very important principle, which is that in this country, everyone should have access, everyone should have access to quality, affordable health care, starting from the day you're born, continuing until your senior years, and leave nobody out. And Senator Obama, I know he's well-intended, and I think highly of Barack. I have nothing negative to say about him, but almost all the experts who've looked at this have concluded that his proposal would leave millions of people out, and that's bad for them. It's also bad for everybody else who has to end up paying their bills. So her health care proposal, which is very important, not only in terms of health care, but economic competitiveness and a variety of other things, balancing the federal budget by getting health care costs down, is, I believe, a superior one, and that is a key difference between the two of them.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, and Paul Krugman laid it out quite eloquently today in the New York Times. On the other hand, you know, it seems like single-payer health care would solve the problem. It just basically Medicare for all. Everybody in the United States is now covered by Medicare, would solve the whole problem instantly. I mean, the Republicans are going to beat her about the head and shoulders with this. Oh, they're going to garnish your wages if you don't buy health insurance. I mean, why not just get the health insurance companies the hell out of the business?
Well, what she's proposed, I mean, if you take that line of argument, then I think you would also have to be opposed to Social Security, for example.
Well, the Republicans are.
but we're talking about our primary right now.
Right, I understand.
Our candidates.
I understand.
You know, Barack, who, again, is a good guy, you know, does question her about this, but if you follow his line of attack against her to its logical conclusion, you would also have to be opposed to Social Security, and you'd also have to be opposed to Medicare that everyone pays into.
Right.
So I don't view that as being really a very sound criticism of her proposal. And on this one, Tom, I think she's got the superior approach. And, you know, the difference between that and universal, you know, we can talk about that. And if it was a Democrats-only process here, you might get a majority of support for that. But what she's tried to do is to stake out a principled ground, but also one that is practical, one that will actually accomplish the end result and can actually get done. And the real concern is, and I think, frankly, it's a legitimate one, is that if you go with the universal approach, it simply won't get done as long as the Republicans can filibuster something with 40 votes in the United States Senate.
Yeah, this is a problem. This is a real problem.
Well, we're electing senators this fall, too, so maybe we can correct that at the same time we're dealing with the presidency.
There you go. So, in a nutshell, the reasons why you believe that our listeners, and we're on the air right now live from Los Angeles to New York City, why our listeners should be supporting Hillary Clinton?
Her personal strength, which I've observed, I mean, she's tough. She'll fight for the things that she believes in, which is going to be necessary to actually make the change that people want. You know, either one of our candidates is going to make history, and that's a good thing. The question is, which one of them, in addition to making history and elevating people's hopes, is actually in a position to deliver on those hopes, to produce the kind of results that people want in their daily lives? And I think that her extensive experience of seeing how things get done, of knowing how to go about it in the right kind of way, and candidly, Tom, she's learned from her mistakes as well as from things that have gone right. I think that puts her in a better position among two very good people to actually get done, to produce the results that this country and our citizens so desperately need.
Senator, you're an eloquent spokesman for your candidate, and I appreciate you coming on the program.
Tom, it's good to be with you.
Thank you. Senator Evan Bayh, the Democrat from Indiana. And 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and your thoughts on this. George in Los Angeles. Hey, George, listening on K-Talk.
Well, whoever the Democrats put up for to run for the presidency against the Republican candidate, I'm going to vote for them because we don't want another Republican president appointing a kangaroo judge to the Supreme Court.
Right, and there's going to be one and probably two, possibly even three of those appointments in the next couple of years.
That would be a disaster for the next 50 years because they're, you know, like Roosevelt, that he picked young guys that expect to live to be 70 or 80 years old. And the fact is that I would put up $1,000 to impeach Scalia and Thomas. Thomas for lying about his orientation to porno movies. U.S. News and World Report ran at the same time he was being before the Senate Confirmation Committee about his love for porno. And in his new book, he's attacking, trying to reinvent himself by attacking Anita Hill. And Scalia met with defendants that had cases before, you know, Cheney before the Supreme Court, and then his briefs came out in favor of the defendant. So, and he says there's no improprieties. I don't believe that because if there weren't any, he shouldn't have had any. Make it appear that there would be. But I would, George, I would too.
If somebody came along and said, okay, we're organizing a political action committee here to impeach Scalia and Thomas. Do you want to kick some money into it? I would too. Right there with you. Brenda in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Brenda.
Hi, Tom. A lady called in not that long ago, and she was saying that Obama supporters seem to just generalize in their reasons for supporting him. They support him because he's for hope, et cetera, and they don't have any real substantial reasons. In my opinion, I've seen the same thing on their side, and I think it is because the two candidates are so closely aligned when it comes to the policy issues. I would tend to agree with her more on the health care. She has basically Edwards policy. And I would agree with Obama much more on the war.
Yeah, but yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you know, we have to, each one of us, you know, look inside and find out and think of it. Brenda, thank you very much for the call. Each one of us has to come to a conclusion here in the next 24 hours if you're in one of the Super Tuesday states. And please do. Please get out there and vote. Please participate. But it has to be your decision. Mar in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Mar.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I was calling to illustrate in my own family why we are supporting Barack Obama. We evaluated the differences between the candidates. Let me just briefly sum it up. I'm 56 years old. I'm one of 12 children. We are across the United States. I'm in Oregon. I have brothers and sisters in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Germany, New York, etc. We were divided during this 8-year term of President Bush, very deeply divided and couldn't speak to one another because of people in the family supporting Bush and his policies and others of us who really could not understand their brain disease. In any case, when evaluating these contests, I had brothers who were very staunch Bush supporters who determined they could not be Republicans any longer because of the Constitution. Barack Obama has healed our family. When we were evaluating it, they are so entrenched with regards to Hillary Clinton that for whatever reason, logical, illogical, all I can speak to is I have hope for the first time that our own family can begin to heal its wounds and talk to one another. And that's why I'm glad to see that we're able to unite around Barack Obama.
Yeah, that's a marvelous story, Mark. Thank you very much for sharing it with us. Cindy in Orange County, about a half a minute here, Cindy.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Let me say how much I appreciate you and your historical knowledge. But the thing I want to ask is something that you touched on last week, and I wasn't able to hear your whole answer, and I'm struggling to decide what to do tomorrow. I'm in California, and I'm, you know. But I want to know why I wouldn't consider voting for Edwards in hopes of him getting the 15% and thus more delegates.
Because Edwards has pulled himself out of the race. I mean, you know, he made that very clear. His campaign is not going on right now. We have two candidates here, and Edwards supporters in particular need to be making a choice between one of these two candidates. Otherwise, their voice is not going to be heard. And that's why, frankly, Cindy, I think that it's really important for those of us who have thought that John Edwards was the most viable candidate to be taking a very, very careful look at these two candidates and making a decision. If you live in one of the Super Tuesday states, making a decision tomorrow. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Do you know what your fate is? Now you're trying to shake it.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers, healthcare workers of SEIU 1199, asserting that healthcare should be a right in these here United States, like it is in every other industrialized country in the world, not merely a privilege. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Services on the line with us from Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their extraordinary website. Hey, Ellen.
Well, the budget is out, and the first thing the Republicans mainly did was to say that the Democrats won't comply with an end to various earmarks. And so they're trying to look very responsible by going after earmarks.
Yeah. Wasn't George Bush responsible himself and he and his party for large quantities of earmarks during the years that the Republicans were in control of the House and Senate?
Well, I mean, actually, the earmarks are not generally originated at the White House. They're actually originated by individual members. But, of course, the White House can ask that a specific member do an earmark, and that
right.
may have been happening. Meanwhile, on the overall budget issue, the White House is now saying that the reason this was on a Jim Nussel OMB briefing this afternoon at the White House, and he's basically saying, well, if we don't have if we are not safe, then our economy will collapse, which is the reason that the war spending is so big, and they're saying that it will protect our country. Now, the numbers are quite staggering. They're going to run like a $413 or $412 billion deficit this year. I think it's $407 next year, and the total spending is $3.1 trillion. Of course, it is true that a lot of that is Social Security, et cetera. The increase in defense and security spending is 8.2%. The budget does include the stimulus package, but it does not include $70 billion for Iraq, which they call an emergency allocation. How do you like that, an emergency
yeah.
allocation? And then they expect there to be another $100 billion, but they're not sure what that second number is going to be because General Petraeus, if you recall, said he would be back in March to report on the surge and other things. And it is that point that they will make their second request, expected again to be somewhere around $100 billion, but it could be more.
Wow. Wow. And I mean, when you consider what could be done with this money, I mean, we could be hiring tens of thousands of public school teachers, hundreds of thousands of police officers, well, probably hundreds of thousands of school teachers if you take the total cost of the war. We could be building schools. We could we could be putting kids through college. I mean, we could do like most European countries do, or northern European countries anyway, and offer free college education to anybody who qualifies.
Listen, I hate to be like Machiavelli, but I got to tell you, you could probably pay off the warring factions in Iraq with billions of dollars at a whole lot less it's costing us to do the war there, and they'd probably be happy.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, that's what we were doing with the Taliban. You'll recall in the first months of the Bush administration, George Bush gave the Taliban, was it $30 billion? And in exchange for them stopping growing opium, and they actually had the smallest opium crop in the country the following year.
Absolutely.
I mean, he just said, hey, you know, well, yeah, we'll use some bucks here. So, anyhow,
Nancy Pelosi, and actually Harry Reid, each issued statements. She said that, of course, there were cuts to seniors and health care. There was a freeze on medical research. They increased the costs for veterans for their health care in terms of co-payments, et cetera, decreasing energy assistance, and, of course, not the true cost of the war, which is also true. And then he claims he's going to get a surplus in the budget by 2012. I don't know what, of course, he won't be president then, and I don't know what planet he's on that one.
Yeah, well.
Something else that, of course, a lot of people are talking about Hillary Clinton and the fact that, you know, there was this, the right wing is certainly pushing her garnishment of wages and trying to make her look bad on health care. But, you know, Tom, this is something I actually did quite a bit of thinking about on the weekend. I'm sort of curious about your thought. It doesn't really matter if everybody buys a health insurance policy, because health care is now 17% of the GDP, up from 13% in the year 2000, going to go up to 20% of the GDP by probably 2012, 2014, somewhere around there. To me, it doesn't make a difference whether it's from insurance companies or we pay. It's still a hit on the GDP. Nobody's talking about exporting medical technology, which we're very good at in our country, to help balance that medical care cost.
Hmm. That's interesting. Except that, I mean, how long is it going to be before they start manufacturing all of our medical technology overseas as well?
We need to change our trade policies first. That is where we do patents and all that other kind of stuff. And that's also, I mean, it's interesting. The UAE, the Cleveland Clinic is going to be there in the Emirates. Johns Hopkins is going to be there. So it's already starting to happen. But if we're going to talk about budget and putting money into research, we're reducing the cost in the president's budget of medical research. Probably one of the best products we can export.
Yeah, yeah. And cutting back on R&D. Amazing. What else is going on in Washington, D.C., Ellen?
Well, I mean, just obviously the elections are hot on the hit parade. And the other thing is that whether they're going to call in both McCain from the Republican side, Obama and Hillary on the FISA bill, which is happening on Wednesday, and how they're going to vote.
Now, does this bill have amnesty for Bush and the phone companies?
It depends which amendment they look at. Uh-huh. They did get an agreement at the end of the week for an up or down vote on some of this, and that's why Harry Reid may have to lean very hard on Obama and Hillary to come in on Wednesday and vote.
Interesting. So it's getting down to the wire, as they say.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
It will be, you know, and that is really going to be a large part of the focus this week in the Senate. Now, tomorrow we'll start a lot of the budget bills and the defense of them by different members of the cabinet.
Right, yeah, that should be entertaining. But I guess the big event is going to be tomorrow, Super Tuesday.
That's right.
There you go.
People all over the country to report for you.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. Thank you so much. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Great talking with you, Ellen. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeff Cohen on the line with us, media critic, author of Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. And Jeff, welcome to the program.
Always great to be with you.
Also a founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, and the former producer for the Donahue cable show on MSNBC. And you've got an extraordinary, and along with me on the advisory board of Progressive Democrats of America.
That's right.
So anyhow, you wrote a brilliant piece a couple days ago on Common Dreams. It was at least that's where I saw it published. I'm guessing it was all over the web.
Yep.
Called the Stepford Republicans. Tell us about this.
Well, I was looking at these tapes, audio tapes or videotapes of well-known Republicans who once were capable of independent thought and reasoned talk, and over a period of years end up captives, sort of subservient to movements or ideologies that they used to abhor or oppose. And that's why I dubbed them Stepford Republicans. It's like, you know, the Stepford wives are abducted and turned into robots, completely subservient to their husbands. The Stepford Republicans are turned into robotic ideologues who are subservient to these forces that they once were critical of.
Yeah, we have basically in the United States, I mean, it seems to me that the power behind all this is twofold. It's massive inherited wealth, like the Walton family,
yeah,
for example, and the Mars family, and corporate power, corporate wealth, huge corporate wealth and power. And that economic power gets translated into political power through supporting these candidates, and then these candidates take positions, particularly with regard to things like wedge issues, you know, guns, gays,
yeah,
God, abortion, whatnot, merely to win elections, not because they really care about those things. In fact, they traditionally abandon those issues as soon as they get into office so that they can use them again in the next election, but rather so that they can advance the economic interests of the real people behind them.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I mean, these tapes that I'm referring to in the column that I wrote, it shows like Mitt Romney. Romney, I think his main ideology has always been free market fundamentalism.
Right. Now here is the clip of Mitt Romney. I think.
Here, if abortion is morally wrong, aren't you responsible for discouraging it?
One of the great things about our nation, Sally, is that we're each entitled to have strong personal beliefs, and we encourage other people to do the same. But as a nation, we recognize the right of all people to believe as they want, and not to impose our beliefs on other people. I believe that abortion should be safe and legal in this country. I have since the time that my mom took that position when she ran in 1970 as a U.S. Senate candidate. I believe that since Roe v. Wade has been the law for 20 years, that we should sustain and support it. And I sustain and support that law and the right of a woman to make that choice. And my personal beliefs, like the personal beliefs of other people, should not be brought into a political campaign.
Yeah, for example.
Yeah, it's astounding because, yeah, you know, he goes on. This is the 1994 debate with Ted Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
He goes on to embrace affirmative action. He supports blowing away glass ceilings. He talks about how a relative of his passed away from an illegal abortion. And then when Teddy Kennedy is connecting him to Reagan Bush, he makes this comment. This is Mitt Romney. I was an independent during the time of Reagan Bush. I'm not trying to return to Reagan Bush. the theme of my column and you know, the Stepford Republicans is they will become subservient to any movements or ideologies that can get them across the line.
That's right. That pays their way. And,
yeah,
and this is not about flip-flopping. This isn't about, for example, Hillary Clinton right now saying, well, okay, or John Edwards perhaps is a better example, because he actually came out and said it. I shouldn't have voted that way on that war resolution.
Right.
This isn't about reconsidering an issue out of conscience and changing your position out of conscience. This is about craven opportunism. You mentioned Ronald Reagan. These are clips that are in your column, the Stepford Republicans all caught on tape. Here's Ronald Reagan.
This is Ronald Reagan speaking to you from Hollywood. You know me as a motion picture actor. But tonight I'm just a citizen, pretty concerned about the national election next month, and more than a little impatient with those promises the Republicans made before they got control of Congress a couple of years ago. I remember listening to the radio on election night in 1946. Joseph Martin, the Republican Speaker of the House, said very solemnly, and I quote, We Republicans intend to work for a real increase in income for everybody by encouraging more production and lower prices without impairing wages or working conditions. Unquote. Remember that promise, a real increase in income for everybody. But what actually happened? The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. In other words, profits have gone up four times as much as wages. And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices, which have also bored into their savings. For example, here's an Associated Press dispatch I read the other day about Smith L. Carpenter, a craftsman in Union Springs, New York. Seems that Mr. Carpenter retired some years ago, thinking he had enough money saved up so that he could live out his last years without having to worry. But he didn't figure on this Republican inflation, which ate up all his savings, and so he's gone back to work. The reason this is news is Mr. Carpenter is 91 years old. Now, take as a contrast the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which reported a net profit of $210 million after taxes for the first half of 1948, an increase of 70% in 1 year. In other words, high prices have not been caused by higher wages, but by bigger and bigger profits.
He's right.
Yeah, you know... I'm worried, Tom, about people that have just tuned in to your channel, wherever they are in America, and thinking they're having some hallucination. No,
right.
That was, in fact, Ronald Reagan's voice.
Right, in the election of 48, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1948. He's campaigning for the Democrats. He, you know, in that five-minute talk, he questions the Republican rhetoric that the, quote, free market will solve all the problems. He talks against Social Security cuts. He talks against cuts in school lunch programs. He's hailing unions and complaining about labor being handcuffed by the vicious Taft-Hartley law, which was the anti-union bill. So, again, I think Reagan's another example of a Stepford Republican. Clearly, he's an actor who reads scripts that are handed to him. But if people that knew him then and people that knew his upbringing, it was not a – he wasn't in some sort of trance
right.
when he was speaking out for middle-class America in 1948. But he's like a B actor. His career a couple years later isn't going anywhere. And General Electric will pick him up if he changes his ideology on a dime.
Right.
And he does.
Yeah,
and
I understand that Nancy Davis's father, his wife, had some role in that as well. When he remarried Nancy Davis and Nancy Reagan now, and her father kind of brought him into all of this.
Yeah, I was writing this article on the Stepford Republicans, I did a little looking into his history, and yes, the marriage to Nancy happens around that time, but I think mostly what I'm getting at with Stepford Republicans is this craven lust for power. And you know where the power is. And if you want personal power for yourself as an elected official, you know that you'll throw in with these people. McCain's throwing in with the religious right, or trying to, today. Romney did it a few years ago. You have Reagan throwing in with corporate power when he'd been a critic of corporate greed a few years earlier.
Here's a clip of McCain, if we can do this quickly.
Neither party should be defined by pandering to the outer reaches of American politics and the agents of intolerance, whether they be Louis Farrakhan or Al Sharpton on the left, or Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell on the right.
And then a little later on in the clip, you've got him at, giving the keynote at Liberty University and kissing Jerry Falwell.
And being asked specifically by Tim Russert, do you consider Jerry Falwell an agent of intolerance? He says, no.
Right.
What changed? What changed was he got shellacked by these movements. And again, he wants power. I think McCain, you know, who the media are always passing off as the straight talker, he wants power for an ideology of empire, a neoconservative ideology. That's what he really cares about. He's almost admitted he doesn't care as much about economic or corporate issues, but he really cares about this neoconservative agenda, and he was willing to ally with the right wing to get there.
Yeah. Amen. Jeff Cohen. CommonDreams.org, you can find his article and his most recent book, Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. You can find in fine bookstores everywhere and all over the web. And Jeff, a quick website?
Yeah, my own website has this column, jeffcohen.org.
There you go, jeffcohen.org. Thanks a lot for being with us, Jeff.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
I'm that good feeling, I'm that voice, yeah, you know who I am. Listen, old knob, it's your choice, yeah, you know who I, you know who I am.
21 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Scott in Oregon, you're on the air. Hey, Scott, thanks for calling. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to kind of weigh in on the healthcare part of the discussion, especially from today.
Mm-hmm.
My personal opinion is with the mandates for healthcare, I wouldn't have a problem with that as long as it was actually a mandate for healthcare versus a mandate for just continuing to line the insurance company's pocket.
Right, yeah, that's the problem, and that's what I essentially, I mean, I'm trying to be relatively respectful, but I think that that's what I was saying to both Senators Kerry and By, is
right.
That, you know, we should have national health care, not national health insurance, frankly.
Right. And as the candidates start talking about, well, this is a first step, unless they can be really articulate about what their end game is and how they plan to get there and then how this first step contributes, it just kind of feels like more of the same.
Well, yes and no. John Edwards on this program 6-8 months ago or so, we were talking about this, and he said, you know, that Dennis Kucinich's approach of, he didn't specifically name Dennis, but, you know, I said, why not just do away with all the health insurance companies and go to Medicare for all tomorrow? And he said that approach just simply politically won't happen. He said not until you have major campaign finance reform and not until you have an overwhelming Democratic Party majority in both the House and the Senate would you be able to do something like that. It's simply politically impossible. But what is politically possible is to say, hey, you know, everybody's in favor of people having choices, particularly with regard to health care. So we're going to give you a choice. And here's a bunch of different programs that involve for-profit companies and some subsidies and some trimming here and there. And oh, by the way, just at the kind of footnote now down at the bottom, anybody in America can buy into Medicare. And if anybody in America can buy into Medicare at a fraction of the cost of buying regular health insurance, but getting the same kind of coverage, because Medicare operates on a 2 or 3% overhead, and all the other health insurance companies are operating on 20 and 30% overheads, then, you know, within a couple of years, all the other insurance companies are either going to go nonprofit and become significantly different than they are, or they're going to be out of business.
Right.
And that, you know, so there is something to be said for taking an incremental approach over the short term to achieve that goal, given the political the tragic political reality in America right now, much of which, frankly, tracks back to things like Supreme Court decisions that say that money is speech and that corporations are persons. But, you know, that, you know, don't get me off on that tangent, but, I mean, you get the point.
Right.
So I, you know, I agree with you. And the uninsured are paying so much more for their health care right now. It's nuts. I mean, you know, these insurance companies are negotiating prices with hospitals and doctors and things and saving money that way also. And so the uninsured and all the rest of us are paying a huge chunk of the medical bill in the United States.
Right.
And it's an absolute tragedy.
Well, and that was actually the second part of my point was, as a, you know, recent member of the cast-off employee society from a company that I worked for 26 years.
Ouch.
I find myself now in that situation with healthcare where I actually know people who are writing software systems and doing negotiation with the healthcare companies trying to get doctors more money, and realize that the doctors are getting screwed where they're only getting 40 or 50% of what they're asking for. But then I get my recent bill for some work I had to have done, and when I called the provider, you know, not my personal doctor, but one of these, you know, kind of global companies that does diagnostic work, they basically told me, oh, there's no way we can do any negotiation on the price. And I, you know, talked to the guy, and he actually quoted the HIPAA stuff is saying that's what the government tells them, they can't do that. And I said, no, buddy, you don't know what you're talking about. Give me your supervisor, please. And, oh, no, I'll give you an address. I said, yeah, no, give me your supervisor. And so finally get a supervisor on the phone, and they still never would, you know, one way or the other, you know, say that HIPAA had something to do with it. But they
right.
basically said their policy was, you know, the bill is the bill, you got to pay it.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line. Is you're one guy, and they're a big corporation, and they can blow you off. And,
yeah.
and you can't go pick at them, and you can't vote for them like you could vote for a member of Congress, and you can't lobby them like you could lobby a member of Congress to say, hey, wait a minute, my health insurance isn't the way I want it. You make a very eloquent case. Scott, I got to move along, but thank you for your call. Well said. Carol in Oregon. Hey, Carol.
Yes. The reason I'm strongly supporting Obama is the fact, in my book, Good Judgment, Trump's Experience, Any Day of the Week. And in the debate, you listen, they asked her if she would now finally renounce her support of the war, and she waffled out. She would not do it. Not only did she vote for the war, she voted to call Iran a terrorist nation. When it came to saying we weren't going to use cluster bombs, and which kills thousands of thousands of innocent women and children, she voted against that. I mean, I think she tries to prove she's just as tough as the boys. And
I think there may have been some element of that in there. And whether or not that's going to mean that that's the kind of president she's going to be, I don't know. But I think that your point that the reason that you would vote for Obama is important. And I think it's, frankly, with both of these candidates, it's more important that we be deciding what we're voting for than what we're voting against. Carol, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. 27 minutes past the hour. Let's see if we can track down Ambassador John Bolton and see if he thinks it's time to start to bomb Iran. Wouldn't that be interesting? Stick around.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I want my country back the way it was when I was young, when a man could be a Christian and not be Republican, when the trades we made with China weren't so hopelessly unfair, when made in China wasn't found on everything we wear, when national security meant protecting all our borders, when our elected officers didn't choose just to follow orders from corporations bent on power that buy manipulation and handpick their employees now through illegal immigration.
Hi, welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And former Ambassador John Bolton is on the line with us. Ambassador, welcome to the program. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Joseph Ciricione, I am mangling his name, Ciricione, of the think tank Center for American Progress, and Cy Hirsch are both out speaking about how the nuclear weapons plant in Syria that was bombed by the Israelis recently turned out to be pretty much definitely not a nuclear weapons program. You have this recent NIE, this National Intelligence Estimate, suggesting that there is no nuclear program going on in Iran. And yet I'm hearing that you're still advocating action against Iran and supportive of the action in Syria.
Well, I think these individuals are flatly wrong if they think that facility in Syria was not a nuclear plant of some kind. Certainly in the public domain, we don't know whether it was a clone of North Korea's Yongbyon reactor or if it was a uranium enrichment facility or perhaps an assembly facility for nuclear weapons. We're in the dark as far as the public is concerned. But I think there's almost no doubt that it was a nuclear facility with North Korean involvement. And every indication that I've seen, including my conversations with both American and Israeli officials, lead me to that conclusion. So I think the Israelis were entirely correct to preemptively take that facility out. And I think the Syrians' own conduct helps prove that. If it was, as they've said publicly, an unused Syrian military facility, why not to let the world in and show it to them?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Iran is doing right now. We have,
no, they're not.
We have nuclear inspectors. The IAEA has inspectors in Iran.
You know, look, the Iranians for close to 20 years have lied to the International Atomic Energy Agency. They have revealed data selectively, and they're going through the same drill now with a very cooperative director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The IAEA knows only what it knows, and it doesn't know what it doesn't know. So its conclusions are very limited, and the Iranians know that, and they've been playing off the IAEA for some time now, trying to get out from under what remain, at least in theory, mandatory resolutions of the Security Council calling on them to suspend their uranium enrichment program.
The uranium enrichment for peaceful production of electricity?
Sure. If you believe that, you know, there's probably a bridge you should be looking at. The Iranian claim that they want civil nuclear power is based on their contention that they are running out of oil and natural gas. Sometime ago,
that they've got about a 25-year supply.
The Department of Energy some years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, looking at Iran's current rate of domestic consumption and export, concluded that based on what they knew of Iran's reserves, Iran had between 300 and 400 years of supply, not 25. Yeah.
Well, they also have some of the world's largest reserves of uranium.
Well, that's correct, and that's one reason why, despite the NIE, and I'd be happy to talk about that at some length, the decision when and under what circumstances Iran could proceed to a nuclear weapon status remains entirely in their hands, and I find that a very threatening circumstance.
You were one of the major advocates for attacking Iraq, and this was, it's kind of deja vu all over again here. I mean, you were saying essentially the same thing about Iraq, turned out not to be true. Why should we be considering your words now?
Well, you know, the policy to overthrow Saddam Hussein was a policy adopted by Congress through a number of pieces of legislation in the late 1990s adopted by overwhelming bipartisan majorities of both houses.
Not by military force.
With the full understanding, having just fought one war against Saddam Hussein in 1991, that overthrowing that regime might require the use of force. If they weren't prepared to accept it, they shouldn't have voted for it in
that was
the late
not embedded
1990s.
In, yeah, and that was
and that
not
was
embedded
under
in
President
any of that
Clinton.
Legislation.
That's exactly right.
And there was no military force included in any of that legislation.
Yeah,
that came along with George W. Bush.
The point that I just made was that everybody who voted in favor of it had the experience only a few years before of the use of force against Saddam Hussein, and the criticism that President Bush 41 had not gone far enough after expelling Iraq from Kuwait, had not gone far enough to overthrow that regime.
But back to the point that there was no nuclear weapons program in Iraq. The IAEA did have inspectors in Iraq, just like they do right now in Iran, and they were saying the exact same thing. We're finding no evidence here of bomb making going on. And yet,
the IAEA
you were saying,
wouldn't know where to look to find out about bombing.
Well, but
the IAEA's capabilities are to look at the potential diversion of declared nuclear facilities and the diversion of radioactivity from such facilities. For example, in 2004, after the supposed halt of Iran's weapons design program, there was information about the Iranian effort to shape conventional explosives in a way that would be necessary to implode a hollow uranium or plutonium sphere to create the critical mass that you need for an uncontrolled nuclear reaction. And those allegations were about an Iranian facility that fundamentally deals with armor and artillery, no nuclear aspects there at all. The Iranians denied that they were doing that. The IAEA has never inspected that facility. That's yet another example of, and that was reported by ABC News, yet another example of the Iranian efforts that the IAEA can't comment on one way or the other.
So why then is the Bush administration, if what you're saying is right, and I suspect you believe it to be the case, then why is the Bush administration not taking more aggressive action?
Well, because I think the NIE has shredded their policy. I didn't think the policy was robust enough, but let there be no mistake. I don't think that the administration has a policy left at this point diplomatically. You can see now the efforts to get a third sanctions resolution in the Security Council are going nowhere fast, and the Iranians...
Because nobody else believes this.
Well, the British certainly still believe it. The Israelis still believe it. And, in fact, if you have read the NIE, including its critical footnotes, you will know that the only thing that the NIE claims the Iranians suspended in 2003 was weapons design and actual weaponization. Now, that's an important part of a nuclear weapons program, but it's a tiny sliver of the total activity that Iran needs to pursue. The vice of this NIE was the highly politicized way in which it was written. And it had the desired impact because many people never got beyond that very first sentence.
Yeah. The candidate who looks like he's probably going to be the candidate for president on the Republican side, John McCain, famously sang the song Bomb, 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 Iran. If he's elected president, do you expect that that will be one of his first orders of business?
Well, my suggestion to you would be get a sense of humor. This is what McCain has said, and it's a point that I certainly agree with, contrary to something you said about my position earlier. McCain has said accurately that the use of military force against Iran's nuclear program is not an attractive option. It's very much an option of last resort. But it has to be an option that's on the table compared to the alternative of allowing Iran to get a nuclear weapons capability.
Well, I mean, for every country in the world, the option of being defensive, using military power in a defensive mode, even if it must be preemptively defensive, there's a long history of that. But the question does this rise to that level? And Iran is saying no, it doesn't. The IAEA is saying no, it doesn't. The UN is saying no, it doesn't.
The UN is saying no, it doesn't. Who in the UN is saying that?
Well, who in the UN is saying that it does? Well, the IAEA is saying it doesn't, and the IAEA is the agency of the UN that's supposed to say that.
My point to you is the IAEA lacks the capacity to say definitively one way or the other whether Iran or anyone else is pursuing a clandestine nuclear weapons program. The IAEA has no independent capability to investigate other than through information that's provided to it or that's declared to it by the countries through their safeguards agreements. It's not a spy agency.
Right. Well, I mean, other than spy...
Who do you think gives them most of their information?
Their inspectors.
You have
Mohammed al-Baradei who has inspectors in there.
What do you think the inspectors inspect?
Well, they're inspecting the atomic facilities.
The declared atomic facilities, sir. The declared atomic facilities, not the undeclared ones.
Okay. Former Ambassador John Bolton, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, author of Surrender is Not an Option, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI.org. Ambassador, thanks for dropping by.
Happy to do it.
45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Because I believe someday you're going to do me proud. It's written on your soul to rise above the crowd. Hear the angels sing your praises right out loud. Yeah, I believe someday you're gonna do me proud.
9.5 minutes before the hour. Hey, just a quick heads up. Progressive to our Seattle listeners, a marvelous city where I've actually beat Rush Limbaugh on the ratings. Progressive Talk AM 1090, KPTK, is partnering with Cell Phones for Soldiers to send used cell phones over to soldiers overseas so that they can use them complete with prepaid minutes. So if you have a used cell phone, recycle it by dropping it off at the studios of AM 1090. That's at 1000 Dexter Avenue North, Suite 100 in Seattle. And you can check out their website and am1090seattle.com and find out all about it. So it's a great program. Just a quick heads up. Let's get some calls in here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. I'm going to ask you to make a quick point, because we've got the lines are slammed. A lot of people who want to make comments, and let's just go through them very quickly. Diana in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Diana.
Hi, Tom. I'll make it quick then.
Thank you.
I just want American voters like myself who haven't voted yet to remember that you do not want to reward someone who has voted for this war, or nor has they have they disavowed this vote they took, such as Hillary Clinton, and that Barack Obama was running for the Senate when he said he was against this war. I am voting for Barack Obama. There is no way my husband would ever vote for Hillary Clinton. Please, if you're splitting your ticket, do not have your wife vote for Hillary or yourself.
Okay.
You're not going to reward somebody for doing what she did.
Diana, I'm still making up my mind, but thank you for your comments. So well said. Bill in Columbia, South Carolina. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to say that I think Hillary's negatives are way too high. I'm looking at a Mason-Dixon survey.
Mm-hmm.
Says that she's the only candidate who registers a net unfavorable, and 52% of their respondents, of likely voters, said that they wouldn't vote for her.
Yeah, so you think that because her negatives are so high that she's unelectable. Wait until, if Obama is the nominee, wait until the Republicans get done with him. I mean, they've been working on her. Not to say that he shouldn't be the nominee. In fact, I'm probably more leaning in his direction than hers, but I don't know. Frank in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Frank.
Hey, I'm still undecided, but I don't think I want a kumbaya president. I want somebody that's strong that's going in there to say, this is the way it's going to be, and tell that to the other side.
How do you know that that's not Barack Obama?
Because he's already said that. I want to bring them all together. I don't want that. Since when was having a Reagan Democrat considered a good thing? All that brought was capitulation. I don't want that.
Well, given what's going on with the Supreme Court, any Democrat right now, and then let's get the Democrat in office, and then let's push them like crazy to move in the appropriate direction. Thanks, Frank. Marcine in California.
Hi. I just wanted to report on the Super Bowl party I went to yesterday, and
mm-hmm.
I'm really impressed about the support for Obama. I mean, we have this party every year, and it's people on our street, and it wasn't like anybody got together and was talking about this.
Yeah.
It was just purely enthusiasm for Obama.
Yep. Yeah, well, it's just like our progressive straw poll here on the program was about 4-1 Obama over Hillary Clinton.
And every time I have an Obama button on,
mm-hmm.
somebody covets it and wants it, and I'm giving it away.
Okay.
And I'm constantly running out of buttons.
Great.
There's enthusiasm.
Yeah, there definitely is, Marcine. Thanks for the call. By the way, I also wanted to welcome our newest affiliate, KBAI, AM 930 in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, welcome, guys. Thanks for picking up our show and carrying our program live. Barbara in Libertyville, Illinois. Hey, Barbara.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I was going to use my tax refund to go on the next Air America cruise, but instead, now that I've heard you guys today, I would definitely give it to this law firm to prosecute the crook.
Yeah, all we have to do is find the law firm and get the legal action going. There you go. Barbara, thank you.
One other point.
Sure.
Don't just tell us, Mr. Senators, how many Republicans will filibuster. Make them actually do it.
I know.
It's driving me crazy.
I absolutely agree. And I just, I didn't want to get into that debate with Messrs. Bye and Kerry because it wasn't the moment. I mean, they were there to speak for Canada.
Now is the moment. They've got to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, they need to be listening to their constituents, not a talk show host on those issues. Mike and Marina Del Rey.
Yes, Tom, great show, love your show. I just want to know what your thoughts are on this Exelon thing and the New York Times article about Barack Obama and what's the truth?
I don't know the truth. And like I said, you could find 15 problems with Barack Obama and 15 problems with Hillary Clinton. It's or 15 pluses and or pick your number. The bottom line, I don't think either of these guys are as badly impaired as John McCain or Mitt Romney. I mean, that's what it simply boils down to. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Is this on?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Tom, with all the misdirection and spin that's taking place in the media today, I kind of feel that, you have to read between the lines and listen to what's not being said as much as you do what is being said. And a good example of this would be the way that our senators and congressmen are totally silent about the obscene profits of the oil companies. And I think that their silence speaks volumes about their influence of big oil in government. And with regards to the candidates, it bothers me that neither one of them is talking about what they're going to do to bring jobs back to this country. Obama could be slamming Hillary on NAFTA, and he's not saying anything about it. And I'm wondering what your spin is as to why he's not mentioning it.
I don't know. My initial guess is that there's so much money in both of these campaigns that they're not yet willing to bite the hands of the people who feed them. Hopefully that will change. but that's my take on what where it's at right now. No, they are, neither one of them is as progressive as I would like. Both of them, though, are just one hell of a lot better than any Republican out there. By the way, special election night coverage on Air America tomorrow night from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. Mark Green, David Bender, Rachel Maddow, me, Lionel, a whole bunch of folks are going to be here, so check that out. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Take a stand, take a position, and be sure to vote tomorrow. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmannRadio.com.
Tag, you're it!